You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is the last Orthodox Nationalist of 2022, and it's going to air on the 28th of December. As we come to the end of this year typified by two things. The first is the fact that I got married in February, and the second, maybe not entirely unrelated, Russia's invasion of Ukraine, which radically altered the nature of the globe from now on. Both are of equal geopolitical significance, of course. And I need to thank everybody, especially those of you who bought my latest book, which is selling very well, and those who supported me in a year where it gets more and more difficult to support anybody, yourselves, and let alone someone else. If you haven't yet signed up for my Patreon, please do so. I have so much eclectic material on there. It's probably worth your time, and you can only get it from behind the paywall there. We're going to end the year on something that's both depressing, but that exposes a lot about who our enemies are. People talk about this. Once in a while, they drop the name. They talk about the body count and everything else, but they don't know much about it. And the American academic and journalistic establishment have made sure of that. And that's the rule of Mao Zedong, specifically his Great Leap Forward from 1958 to 1962. The fact that you can be a Maoist in American society and have zero sanctions on you for this shows you who rules us. Leftist mass murderers have always been given a pass, from the New York Times in Soviet Ukraine to Chomsky defending the Cambodians. Cambodia, of course, was just a miniature version of Mao's Great Leap Forward. In fact, it is almost identical, but you'll notice as we describe it how similar it is to our situation today. The exact same tactics are used. Very little here is going to be found in your typical history textbook. But almost all of what I'm saying here can be found directly from Communist Party documents, from the mid-50s to even almost the present day. The Great Leap Forward was the heart of Mao's version of Leninism. It's consistent with both Marxism and materialism. They keep the materialist mentality in mind throughout. The deliberately manipulative use of language. Some of you know that I have a book on China coming out. And it starts after the Great Leap Forward, and why Chinese socialism changed so radically after Mao's death in 1976. Well, in 1958, Mao, due to his previous dependence on Stalin, did his own variation of collectivization, which is another term for forced industrialization, and the deliberate creation of a mass famine, the likes of which have never existed. The numbers vary, but I'm going to go with the Communist Party's numbers at the time of about 55 million dead, 55 million above and beyond who would have died normally, and that this was deliberate. The point was to use this chaos and destruction over time, enforced, to build a, or to establish a clean break with the past. The concept of revolution taken to its conclusion. So, of course, in 1949, the Maoists take the capital, Beijing or Peking, and the first thing that Mao did was go to Stalin for assistance. And he was treated initially with contempt. One of these days I'm going to do something on the warlord era and why that is. I was going to do that to start off with, but I wanted to end the year on this. He went to the USSR to industrialize China. And of course, the USSR was industrialized by the United States, which is a thesis which is gaining traction even in mainstream sources. They became extremely dependent on Soviet assistance. So China then came under Moscow directly. But whatever assistance, typical socialist mentality here, whatever assistance the Soviets gave had to be repaid. And that's a key issue for later. The revolution, like all leftist revolutions throughout the world, promise that agricultural land is going to be divided up and redistributed to those who till it. Well, that might be a national socialist idea, but the international socialists never took that seriously. Your typical journalists and academics who will talk about that this is a socialist idea, despite the fact that they don't believe in private property. So I'm not sure how you can redistribute land to peasants on the one hand and reject private property on the other. Of course, it's just a story that they tell to get support. The left is never honest about its aims. Nevertheless, the landlord class, we're talking about everything from peasant land holdings all the way to large landlords, which after the wars of both the Civil War and the Warlord Wars, was very unsettled. Lords were tortured to death, mocked, attacked deliberately, and roughly a million of them were executed. And that's from 1950 to 1952. Many of these people were peasants, by the way. They didn't really have the lord-peasant distinction like you had in Western Europe, but we can approximate it to some extent. It was clear, and then Mao fully admitted this later on, that this redistribution of land was a purely temporary measure. Of course, he didn't believe in private peasant land ownership, communal or otherwise. And of course, like every leftist ruler, they fear a strong, independent, middle sector, middle class peasant land owning class, the yeomanry, as we call it. So very quickly, once the older group was eliminated, redistribution occurred for a couple of years at the most, then collectivization. And that began in 1953. So peasants had to return everything that they had been given. The entire thing was a ruse, was a show. A lot of things here are going to be a ruse. Nikita Khrushchev, of course, by now, established himself as the head of the party, condemned Stalin, and condemned collectivization. We all know this. This famous anti-Stalin speech, which confused the socialist world. China began to waver on this policy that the Soviets, who had first created it, now were condemning it. And it created tremendous confusion in the Soviet Union itself. Mao's response to this was to, very strangely, permit open discussion, including criticism, of the party on this and many other issues. This was called by him in the Western press the 100 Flowers Campaign. He always used names like this deliberately to cover their real intentions. Well, his people not only condemned collectivization, but Marxism itself, Stalinism, the entire idea of taking an ideology wholesale from Westerners. This is supposed to be an independent China. Now it's a dependency of the USSR. Nothing has changed. But of course, like everything that Mao did and everything that leftist dictators do, it was a ruse. The point was to flush out dissenters. And he wasn't shy about admitting this. The point of free speech here was to find out who his opponents were. And this was known as the anti-rightist campaign. Anyone who opposed Mao was considered a rightist. And the leaders, as well as the followers, were very quickly arrested. So when the forced labor camps were established, but they became redundant because once the Great Leap Forward started in 1958, the entire country was a forced labor camp. And that is understating the issue. About 70% of those in the camps died, and the rest were never permitted back in society again. The point was to establish total and complete party control over every conceivable institution that could have any influence over people in the country. And it was rapid and extremely violent. The anti-rightist campaign led to all local politicians being replaced by not just party members. I mean, the party membership wasn't enough. Those who followed Mao completely. But this was all necessary for the Great Leap Forward to take place. Forced industrialization, this utter totalitarian restructuring of the society, can't occur in any with any kind of diversity, with any kind of decentralization. Khrushchev, noticing all of this, condemned Mao. And in fact, Khrushchev's condemnation of Stalin, which was hypocritical, as we all know, of course, Khrushchev was a loyal lieutenant of Stalin. In his rejection of Stalin, he rejected Mao too, seeing them as very similar. Peasants were then drafted, typical socialist style. This gigantism, these massive mega projects, it never seemed to go anywhere. Labor was seen as an abstraction, which is typical. It comes straight out of Marxism. Skill and these things weren't important, but labor was seen as an abstraction. Labor and value as really two sides of the same coin. Labor was simply an object, the object that creates value. So there was no rational allocation here. Dare to think, dare to act was the slogan in Chinese. The slogan was, beyond that, we will suffer for 2 years, we'll be happy for 1,000 years. The justification of so much of this was based on the idea that we need to suffer for a long time because soon we will, in Mao's words, create a paradise. One example that people always mention here was the sparrow-smashing campaign. And it's just an example. It's a bizarre, twisted example about how these things operate. The Great Leap Forward was run by people who didn't know the first thing about industry or farming. And the cadres that controlled the collectives were incredibly ignorant people. The only qualification was to support Mao and everything. Sparrows, and of course, the crops, there wasn't a good harvest from there on in. They had a problem with sparrows eating the crops, or at the very least, this is what the party said was the fault here. So they drafted millions of people to kill every sparrow they could find. And it was almost like a quick experiment, seeing how riled up we can get people. And it succeeded. But no one noticed that if you kill these birds, the insects are going to double and triple and quadruple and they're going to blanket the country. The point was, they needed to create something to hate, something to fear, to mobilize people. And they started slowly but surely. I mean, even during the Civil War, Mao leveled entire cities. Again, if you're a materialist, there's nothing wrong with this. There's nothing special about human life at all. It's just one more manifestation of matter. And it has no greater purpose than anything else. You can't separate man from everything else and still be a consistent materialist. So now, you have bad harvests, and the bugs are going unchecked. They ended up importing sparrows from Southeast Asia. But Mao wasn't shy about this socialist paradise idea. He was promising utopia. So he created, like you had in the Soviet Union, what they call collective farms. Or sometimes they call them communes, but they're not. Communes are not like this. These are simple collectives. To the point where there were hundreds in each one. I say hundreds of families in each one. In fact, the plan was to have these massive communes of thousands and thousands of families. They work tremendous hours. They'd play music. You know, they'd have all these sloganeering, these chants. It's like working at Walmart. Ridiculous hours. And since anything other than the party could never be seen as a basis of anything, the family was banned, etc., this collective became the legal and ideological basis of society. And of course, in the process, because there's always, despite the population, production is very low, and so women were drafted in these same labor gangs. And of course, it was interpreted in the West as some sort of feminism. Stalin did the same thing in the mid-30s. Not only was it a way to destroy the family, but it was a way to deal with a labor shortage. So it was considered, you know, you could see the propaganda slogans of liberation and everything else. The family was a huge problem for Mao. And of course, the state ran a nursery system where they were brainwashed ideologically from a very young age. There's all kinds of video of them just, you know, like five-year-olds spouting these slogans. Sex, because of this, was regulated. Men and women were segregated, lest they actually form families. Marriage was gone, and sex could only take place for the sake of producing a new generation under strict party control. Marriage was a thing of the past. So there was no interaction between the sexes for that very reason. But everything was collectivized. There was no personal property. Private property is one thing that usually refers to capital or land. No, there's no personal property. Pots and pans, everything that you could possibly use, was placed in the collective. And they had collective mess halls, you know, the cafeteria, which is where everyone ate. The difference between a commune and a collective is that the collective was people randomly thrown together, forcibly thrown together. It's not a community. A community is a natural institution. Now, the idea of money temporarily was eliminated in the collective. The collective was going to be the cell of the new man, of the new society. You earned work points. Food, because there was always shortages, food was distributed according to how much you worked. How much you worked was something that the party cadre in the collective decided. You earned work points, and those could be exchanged for food. No work, no food. If someone said you weren't working, you didn't get any food. Skills, as I mentioned before, didn't have any relevance. Whether you knew anything about farming or the other nonsense we'll talk about here in a minute, didn't make any difference. And remember, of course, party members, Mao's party people, lived very well. The cadres who controlled the collective lived very well. They didn't have to worry about work points or anything else. And the cadres, as time went on, turned these collectives into barracks, and everyone received some kind of rudimentary military training, because again, very typically, they spread this nonsense, they're going to be invaded. Whether by the Japanese or by the Americans or even by the Soviets later on. So this became incredibly regulated. It was purely totalitarian, and no other association was possible except that of the party and the ideology. Every morning, the group leader and the collective would allocate your tasks and would send you out to the fields or wherever. Of course, as I said, productivity was extremely low. This was irrational, and it didn't work. Mao was very well aware of this, and that's what no one in the West at the time really understood. These people had no farming knowledge. With stupid things like the Sparrow Campaign, you had crops that were there being eaten by bugs. It didn't make any difference. The point was cadre control, not efficiency or production or anything else. So as the crisis continued to grow, Mao had an idea to have the collectives compete against each other, which again kind of defeated their purpose. So the winners were given more food and the losers were in serious trouble. It didn't last very long. Now, given the fact that these collectives had quotas to meet, every one of these cadres had to lie. They made up numbers. It was very hard to verify. You didn't have a whole lot of competent people, one way or the other, so they simply made up numbers. These numbers, of course, were spouted to the world, and the world accepted them without criticism. They accepted them because they wanted to accept them. Remember, this was the wave of the future. As far as the American media, the British media, this was the wave of the future. Intellectuals all over the place were lauding both Stalin and Mao. And then later, Pol Pot. Pol Pot was simply just a follower of Mao Zedong. They brought in Western journalists who, under the best of circumstances, are ignorant, easy to manipulate, especially when they want to be manipulated. And they were showing these, you know, prosperous wheat fields to the world, make-believe prosperity, lying numbers. So, by the fall, 1958, food shortages were at a massive crisis level, even in fertile areas, because farming was now completely irrational if it was done at all. Making matters worse, taxes were allocated based on those fake numbers. That means taxes were far higher than what they ordinarily were. So if you lied, said you produced 50% more than you actually did, and the tax was 50%, they took 100% of everything you did, and that became ordinary. So these fake numbers weren't just to keep themselves out of trouble. They had real-world significance. It wasn't just a lie to make them look good. It also was the basis of taxation, which meant that almost everything was confiscated. 1959, it got worse. Now, the party was confiscating everything. All grain. And significantly, they were confiscating it to send to the Soviet Union. Now, I strongly doubt the Soviets believed the nonsense coming from Peking. But, you know, this alleged socialist paradise was demanding repayment. I mean, all the money the U.S. poured into the Soviet Union during the war, none of that was ever repaid. Nor was it demanded to be repaid. Yet the Soviets demanded it out of the Chinese. The Soviet aid was all very odd. They would export whole factories, ultimately coming from the U.S., but they would export them in modular form. You could just kind of put them together. Except that there were no workers. There was no infrastructure. And even Chiang Kai-shek would make fun of this, saying that so much has to happen first before you can industrialize anything. You need to have the infrastructure, the bridges, the roads, the transport, the resources. It has to be this huge grid. It's inherently totalitarian, heavy industrialization, because everything now has to be connected. So the aid that was given meant nothing, and in fact did more damage, since it cost a fortune. Over time, this was called repayment starvation. Nicolae Ceaușescu did it in Romania in the late 70s and early 80s. Now the starvation was very hard to hide. And you started having rumblings even within the party itself. The cadres in the collective had life and death powers. They had power over life and death. They were gods. But this is perfectly normal, given the nature of the ideology. They were stuffed with food. Everyone says that. All the first-hand accounts mention that. Communist Party documents. But part of the purpose here, again, the party was not shy about, you know, later on reporting this. And Mao eventually is going to have a lot of people turn on him. That's a separate issue. That the weak, the elderly, were deliberately eliminated. You know, they had this one thing going for them, this gigantic population, even at the time, and they were going to use it. This is how they used the swarm technique in Korea. Their casualties in the Korean War were gigantic. They were in the millions. Because the cadres not only controlled the labor, the numbers, production, they also controlled the mess hall, the cafeteria. They decided who ate and who didn't. But Mao is just getting started. Again, he was aware of this in detail. 1959, late spring, Mao said, imitating Khrushchev, by the way, that he is going to overtake Great Britain in steel production in just a few years. In fact, he wanted 100 million tons of steel produced in China within 3 years. Despite the fact that they had no resources for this. So peasants now were not just working in the fields, they were also drafted to work in, I guess, what could pass as factories. The comic part of this is that since these factories really didn't work, peasants now had to build their own foundries in their backyard. It was called backyard steel. Somehow they had to build all the infrastructure out of clay and dirt and brick to produce this backyard, what they called steel, from people who didn't really know what steel was. Blast furnaces in people's backyards. God knows how many people were killed from this. And the quotas just increased. Most of China was deforested. Trees were slashed in massive numbers for fuel. There was very little left. By the time this ended in 1962, everything that could be melted down was melted down. Wood was the main fuel source, and so this is what they used for this nonsensical drive. Ultimately, of course, none of this metal was usable. It was ridiculous. And so Mao, of course, lied about it. From the cadre level all the way up to the capital, they made the claim. And again, this was all repeated in the Western press without criticism, that they were in the process of surpassing Great Britain in steel production. More millions were thrown into these factories for absolutely nothing. Media said the quotas were met. In fact, certain places are exceeding these quotas of high-quality steel, and the suffering that may exist is a price worth paying, and this was repeated over and over again. By now, though, the famine was beyond description, and the party was already starting to investigate this. Documents from the various conferences, the Shanghai Conference, I think it was in 1960, the Lujan Conference, July of 1959, all admitted all of this. This is not a theory here. Mao, of course, knew all of this, and slaughtering large numbers of people, especially older people, was part of the strategy. It wasn't irrational. He knew that it would lead this way. He knew where this would go. He knew the trajectory of this kind of policy. And what Mao said explicitly was that we are churning the peasants, you know, in a meat grinder, so to speak, to feed the cities. And this is nothing new for Leninism, wherever it went. In fact, he said that at the Shanghai Conference of the Communist Party. He also said, I don't know if this was Shanghai or Luzon, but one of these two conferences, Mao said that, and it became party doctrine, that half should die so that the other half could live well. And he's talking about the population of China. And with all this, he then raised the quotas for grain production, knowing full well what it would lead to. July 59th, Lujan Conference, the party admitted mass death, mass starvation that derives from deliberate Communist Party policy, or at least Mao's policy. They admitted deforestation, massive infestation of bugs. But because of this, this was also, you know, they were encouraged to talk about this stuff yet again so that dissenters could be shut down. It was the most bizarre attempt to centralize power ever attempted. The party was constantly being purged. Again, the same thing in Cambodia not too long after this. By now, 1960, entire villages and regions had been depopulated. In most places, the estimate, at least at the time, was 1 out of 10 died of starvation. But it's more than that. Of course, it was deliberate starvation. It was accidents. It was dirty water. The lack of infrastructure. The party noted that peasants were eating mud quite often, which led to what they called deadly constipation. Because, you know, maybe they didn't know you weren't supposed to eat mud. But that was the food, and it actually gets much worse than that. Turns out, though, that there were some areas that produced decent numbers. None of it went to anyone but the USSR. The Communist Party hoarded it for itself, and a portion of it was sent abroad to pay this debt. And for many reasons, partially because Mao wanted to show the world that we are independent. We're not dependent on the USSR. And in fact, we're going to pay this debt early. Ceausescu said the exact same thing in the late 70s when he began this process in the early 80s. This was some of the policies that led to his overthrow in 1989. The state granaries were full. Now, monarchs and centuries past maintained these granaries for the sake of opening them during famine. That was not the case during the Great Leap Forward. In fact, these granaries were attacked by starving peasants, and they were allowed to starve. People were aware that these granaries were full. Regions that were particularly hard hit with starvation were sealed off from others. And specifically what that is to protect the cities from seeing or experiencing or being attacked by the starving peasantry. Most of you know that Marxism, leftism, is almost exclusively an urban phenomenon. Rural socialism, rural revolt, tends to be religious and idealistic. This is a left, generally speaking, and Leninism, Marxism, more specifically, has always been an urban phenomenon, part of the reason why it was a Jewish phenomenon in Europe, and why it appealed to them. This also meant that travel was very tightly regulated. The last thing anyone wanted to see were these people cannibalizing each other in the countryside. It's not an accident that the exact same thing happened in the 1930s in parts of Ukraine and southern Russia. This is normal. And it wasn't just to revolutionize, to create chaos, to break the very conservative peasantry, who in old Russia did extremely well. It was also to wipe them out. It was to destroy them. And of course, I have the party document from the USSR in Stalin's era saying the exact same thing. They weren't shy about this, which meant that Western journalists also knew about it. I mean, if you're given this Potemkin village tour, what journalist, even the most idiotic, is going to believe it? They wouldn't do that today. You know, North Korea allegedly tried to do the same thing. No one bought it. They believed it because they wanted to, or at the very least, they believed it because they were told to believe it. Khrushchev is following this with great interest. And he knew, and he had pictures and firsthand accounts of what was going on in many of these areas. And he, when Mao visited Moscow, Khrushchev took him aside and said, "You're losing your mind." Khrushchev later on said that Mao truly believes that he is this divine demiurge who's been chosen by history to recreate Asia in the image of this very foreign ideology. Khrushchev then cut off all aid and assistance from the Communist Party of China. This is one of the big reasons for the Sino-Soviet split. It wasn't so much, the typical slogans are that Khrushchev condemned Stalin and that offended Mao. No, it had more practical causes than this. Khrushchev condemned Mao. Even Stalinists condemned Mao. And his own total, sociopathic disconnect from everything. The fact that this was part of his purification ideology even worried Khrushchev to the point where all of this aid was stopped. As I said, by 1960, you did have some high-ranking Chinese Communist Party members launching investigations. You can't hide this for very long. But they were lied to, of course. The journalists, like François Mitterrand, who became president of France later, said that there was no starvation, that Mao is a great humanitarian, and it's the right-wingers who are attacking him and making this stuff up. But at the time, in the thick of this, 1960, you had several conferences that took place that said tens of millions already have been killed. Remember, these are artificial famines. These are famines that didn't have to happen. And that the truth of the matter was not just covered up, but very crudely covered up. Which is another way of saying that the foreign journalists were aware of this. You could never convince me that they honestly believed that they lived in prosperity when they were shown these prosperous villages and women swimming in the ponds and all these this act, that somehow they immediately bought it and didn't ask any questions. Zhou Enlai, who was, I think, Mao's third in command, began destroying records at this point. The more records he tried to destroy, the more that was being gathered out in the countryside. The military was particularly upset by this because, of course, they have to draw on some of this manpower. There was one report that showed up in the early 60s, and it was one particular area, and they noted that the graves, the fields weren't really being planted, but they were being used as cemeteries. And they noted that the graves in the fields, maybe a year old or so, had been tampered with. That there were no bodies in what clearly were, and even marked as, mass graves. There were no bodies inside. The bodies, though, were taken, and they were burned. They were burned for fuel, they were burned for fertilizer, and they were burned for food. Communist Party at the local level was building these backyard crematoria to get rid of bodies or at least use them for whatever they can be used for. The military made it very clear these are being used for fuel and fertilizer. And this use of bodies became official doctrine. But just like Ukraine in the 1930s, reports of cannibalism came in from all over the place. Official reports, 1961, verified it. Dead bodies were eaten. Living bodies were eaten. People would use the excuse of someone stealing food, especially children who didn't know any better, would steal food, and they would be killed and eaten. This was normal day-to-day policy. Of course, it occurred in 1936 in most of Ukraine and southern Russia, too. This is what happens when insanity sets in, once starvation reaches a certain point. The Hunan province in particular, the party revealed this evil openly. And you now had only military circles and some party circles, the Great Leap Forward had to be stopped. 1962, it was ended. 7,000 cadres running the collectives finally revolted. Very rapidly, the Great Leap Forward was stopped. and all reports and all firsthand documents say the party, and Mao specifically, were clearly and directly responsible. There was some redistribution of functional property by the end of 1962, and at least officially, collectivization was ended, and it ended with the same irrational, bizarre, with the same consequences as it was in the USSR and elsewhere. Western journalists, of course, denied this. As I said, they were brought to Potemkin villages, food everywhere. People paid. This is the new face of China, they would say. Paradise of virtue and plenty was the slogan that was used. Everyone took Mao's word for it. The only people who knew better were actual party members in the countryside. Now, what did Mao do? He saw revolts developing everywhere, the army getting ready to turn on him. Mao, in typical leftist fashion, needed a distraction, and he created what we now today call the Cultural Revolution. This was his way of keeping the party from taking, really talking about, who's responsible for this, or the very fact that the Chinese economy now was non-existent. So they mobilized essentially what was the Antifa groups. They functioned the exact same way. And Mao turned on his own party. The slogan now was fighting career bureaucrats. Bureaucrats suddenly became a problem. And so he created these Red Guards, these informal groupings of young people, many women, or girls, really, and were armed and sent to destroy, in the name of this revolutionary fervor and being a rebel, to destroy anyone really condemning Marxism because of the mass starvation. Many party members were arrested by the Red Guards. All dissent was stopped. They were given all nonsensical lines about being Japanese agents, whatever it took to show how they have turned on the people. The party is condemning Mao, is condemning Chinese independence, to make certain that Mao was not directly blamed for everything that happened. Even decades later, it was a struggle to get people to talk about some of these documents. He ordered historians to write books about covering this up. Of course, leaving the country in ruins. The Cultural Revolution was designed to distract people, designed to reroute attention to destroying the cultural artifacts of pre-Marxist China. So you had what I guess today would be trillions of dollars worth of artifacts and architecture destroyed, torn down, no different than tearing down the statues today. Although this was on a much larger scale and with the same kind of sloganeering and the use of young people who don't know anything, impressionable young women, putting them in uniforms, talking about how important they are, and sending them to destroy. They're thinking that they're autonomous groups fighting the bureaucrats who have oppressed us so badly, when in fact it was just Mao getting rid of his opponents yet again. Just one Machiavellian scam after another. And given the average intelligence of your typical journalist, even then, no one really put this together. Although party members certainly did. Now, the numbers over this four-year period, the low range is about 36 million people killed that wouldn't have died otherwise. Chinese historians, at least today, the consensus is between 55 and 60 million. And a lot of people just, because they really don't know, they put it somewhere in the middle. So it's easy to say between 45 and 50 million were deliberately killed in the Great Leap Forward. Mao needed to destroy the older generation. So the propaganda and the use of the Red Guards in the Cultural Revolution was the next step. Resistance was becoming difficult in the countryside, especially when you didn't have the strength to do anything. Nothing but chaos and confusion. But even the anti-rightist campaign back in 1958 or before 1958, you had roughly 4 million intellectuals that were killed. This was part of the Communist Party consolidation. Now, Mao will die in 1976, and everything is going to change. But once you're surrounded, I've used the phrase that people live in America, live in a sanitized bubble, a censored bubble. That's the whole point of censorship, to create a fake world for people to live in. This kind of intense centralization of quote-unquote news led certain high-ranking members of the party to believe themselves infallible, that these experiments were actually successful. And the Red Guards, being young, easy to manipulate, confused in the best of times, began spreading all of this. And nothing was done. See, the ultimate Marxist, Marx saw himself as the final answer for every historical question. History led up to him. He was the apogee, the zenith of the Enlightenment. And, correctly, saying that the ultimate goal is to turn a society into one big machine. You know, Marx talked about eliminating the differences between agricultural and industrial labor. This was a Stalinist idea, to turn farms into factories. It wasn't so much to eliminate the difference, it was to urbanize everything. That's what the collective was. It was to create a city environment in the countryside. And the infrastructure was never even created for anything. Industrialization was going to occur much later on a very different foundation. In the Leninist mind, no matter what Leninist you're talking about, the only thing that mattered was heavy industry. And therefore, only the cities and the industrial working class made any difference. They were the only ones who deserved to be fed because farmers are ignorant and connected to the old regime and are family-based, and that was out of the question. You take farmers from the countryside and bring them into the city, they forget who they are pretty quickly. The concepts of the destruction of private property, sex segregation, work points in lieu of money, the creation of 26,000 of these collectives in 1958-59, turning these communes into mini factories that were then supposed to be integrated into others to create one big factory system. This was central to the ideology, no matter where you go. The problem is, of course, there's not a whole lot of difference between industrial capitalism on the one hand, industrial Marxism on the other. Industry came from the West and was sent to the East for this purpose. Peasants were forced to be both industrial laborers and farmers, and they couldn't do either one. The random backyard furnaces were comic, but it only just took more people away from the fields and accelerated. There's videos of some of these things functioning. You know, this little barrel-looking thing, it's ridiculous, and of course nothing was produced of any value. So all of this labor was wasted. Backyard steel. Between 30 and 40% of every single building erected in China was destroyed, usually torn apart to be used for fuel or something else. And in many cases, the Red Guards would tear it down. They tore down anything that even looked like it belongs in pre-Marxist China, which was the greatest demolition project in human history. But even when the party turned on Mao, Mao just redoubled his efforts. And of course, throughout all of this, there was no real incentive to work. If you're in a commune, the collective, your incentive is to do just that which will keep you fed. To do the maximum you'll do is something that will keep yourself out of trouble. You have no incentive to go beyond that because it doesn't really make any difference whether you were good or not. Labor was an abstract quality. Forced labor was the norm. No one wanted to do this. No one saw this as futuristic. And don't underestimate how important destroying the older, you know, in ancient China and even up until the 20th century, the elderly were revered in China. To some extent, still are, even outside of the country. And that's why Mao was so, not only was he so anti-family, but he had to eliminate tens of millions of the elderly because they simply couldn't function in the collective system. Now, just like farmers in America have been dispossessed and destroyed and rendered what we call white trash today, calling them ignorant and trashy and all that is a way to justify destroying them. If you dehumanize them, you could take everything they have. Mao, of course, blamed, and even the Cultural Revolution, blamed lazy and ignorant farmers for any shortfalls. It was sabotage, the typical Stalinist language. Anything, all the great medieval architecture of old China was torn down in this era. And Mao was not shy later on about talking about how important this slaughter was. That Mao didn't seem to understand the difference between a capitalist system and a feudal system. Even though those terms only made sense in Western Europe at a certain period of time, he, in a very ignorant way, tried to simply impose it on China, with, again, comic and violent results. There is no real functional difference between Antifa on the one hand and the Red Guards on the other. They're organized in the same principle, they have the same mission, and they're accepted by the state. They don't get in any trouble in America. They're financed. The money's coming from somewhere. No one works. So where's this money coming from? And, you know, the same thing with university protests. He did the same thing in the Cultural Revolution in China. Professors who even criticized Mao slightly were publicly attacked, humiliated, and driven from campus. And they made up stories. They're right-wingers. They're American agents, whatever it is. Mao publicly praised the guards for doing the right thing, continuing the revolution of 1949. They were used to burn books, to burn paintings, to steal anything that wasn't nailed down and bring into the Communist Party coffers. Cultural Revolution, in other words, existed to cover over the failures of the Great Leap Forward. No different than the George Floyd farce was used to cover over the fact that the U.S. has been in a depression for many years, at least since 2008, if not before. And the state and the private actors simply lie about the numbers. If anyone believes that the unemployment rate is 9%, you're off your rocker. Or that investors have great confidence in the future, which is what some of the polling agencies are saying now. So, but the state could separate itself from the Red Guards because they pretended to be autonomous entities when in fact they were encouraged and financed and organized by the party itself. And the party could say they were not the state, but the party, despite the fact there really was no difference between those two things. But just before Mao's death, he was facing mass protests, especially within his own party. Ultimately, everyone turned on the Communist Party of China. The last gasp of the Maoist idea was to blame, later on, the Gang of Four. The Gang of Four were the closest people to Mao, including his wife, who were rounded up after Mao's death. And these were the most public backers of Mao. And this was, and my book starts off with this, that not only Mao's death, mass protests, the hatred of collectivization, and the arrest, and you know, they eventually died of old age, but totally out of power, of the Gang of Four radically altered Chinese so-called communism, and socialism with Chinese characteristics became their variation of national socialism. And it was only after that that China began to actually rationally industrialize and develop. Mao's people and the party tried to blame the Gang of Four rather than Mao. Again, one last attempt to shift the blame. But, of course, media control, tight control over the political class, was a prerequisite for any of this taking place. It was a not just a meltdown of the economy, it was a planned meltdown of the economy. To use Antifa against the universities, against anyone who questioned Mao, as if they're actually autonomous groups of students running around and burning things. The blurring of the distinction between official and unofficial forms of violence. Denying the obvious. These are all things that parallel our day to Mao's. This hatred, I mean, this pathological hatred of nature, and this belief that the party exists to remake the natural order, to deny it and then remake it on their own ideological foundations. It's typical of materialism. The West is just as materialist as Mao ever was. And all of this kind of thing is perfectly consistent with materialism. Calling the farmers, attacking the farmers as reactionaries and hicks, and therefore justifying their dispossession, occurred over in America over the last 40 years. In China, it occurred in a much more rapid fashion. Now, of course, claiming food shortages, when just a few years ago, there was such a massive glut of food that farmers had to be paid not to farm. Now food processing plants being burnt to the ground. Of course, failure then and now being blamed on outside powers. And in China, it was the USSR, the USA, even Japan, whatever, Taiwan. All the fake make-believe pretexts they used to destroy people, considering society one big machine, or the human person to be a big machine. Yet another parallel between the two ages. These ideological slogans, totally taken from the West without any real thought, apply to the Chinese situation. The manipulation of statistics to the point where it was just openly admitted. Everyone living in fear of that one day the guards are going to come to your door, that you're going to be forced to go into a commune, you're going to be forced to chant these slogans, maybe not loudly enough, you'll be thrown out of school, you'll be thrown out of the army, you'll be a non-citizen. That exists today as much as it did in the 50s. That free speech was considered only that which supported Mao Zedong. Whenever it was tolerated, it was only to find out who the evil were. And that this was all fully consistent with their notion, with Mao's notion of people's democracy and Leninism and the apogee of the Enlightenment. The brainwashing, the open brainwashing, especially of young people, the humiliation and segregation, eventually destruction of the older generation, the destruction of things like statues and all the historical eras of China's past, the blatant expropriation of small farmers and calling them rich landlords. All of this exists in America in 2022, the end of 2022, as much as it did in China in 1962. Solzhenitsyn was the first one to make the claim that, you know, Marxism and capitalism were almost identical. Now they are identical. They're based on the same foundations and have the same policies. The only difference I could really see is that the regime today depends more on psychological manipulation. But even that is starting to fail. The use of the mental health system, for example, that wasn't really a thing in China at the time. It was more crude, but that was the nature of the economy at the time. It was irrational by any standard except that of Mao Zedong. And yet today, you can praise Mao to the skies and receive subsidies and tenure. Adolf Hitler, who did the opposite of all of this, of course, will be condemned from day one, despite the fact that he was a humanitarian by comparison, even these guys on their best day. And to try to single out Stalin or Pol Pot is dishonest. Leninism is identical no matter where it is found. And in certain places, it's usually not around long enough, or it doesn't have the infrastructure of the bureaucracy to really produce the quick results of Stalin or Mao. But most of all, it requires the ignorance of journalists and academics to allow this to go. And because of the prisoner's dilemma, it's really hard to join with others to condemn the system because it's so easy to denounce. Of course, just like today, people are encouraged to denounce each other to the authorities, and they get rewarded as a result. That's the foundation of Leninism and Marxism as it's manifest in the Great Leap Forward and to a lesser extent in the Cultural Revolution that took place afterwards. It was only after all of this was deliberately attacked and these people arrested and destroyed that China was put on some kind of national socialist path and remains a successful state to this day. All of a sudden now, China's condemned for things they aren't doing, and yet Mao was praised, despite the fact that he was doing the things that today's China is accused of doing, but of course is not. Everything is backwards. Everything is inverted. So long as communists are in power, the West is going to support them. A nationalist comes into power, and now they're evil. That's the master key to world politics. Thank you, everyone, for supporting me in 2022. And the next time I speak to you, it will be 2023. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Bye-bye.